and welcome to another episode of the Audaciousness Podcast with me, Helen Strong.
And me, Maribel Ortega. In this podcast, we showcase individuals who have set themselves bold and audacious goals and have worked to achieve them, with the aim of inspiring others to also set themselves audacious goals and to create a positive movement in the world.
We'd like to highlight the fact that even regular people like you and me can have audacious goals, and that role models are, in fact, all around us. Each and every one of us can have an impact in some way.
Thank you for listening. We are delighted to have you with us.
So, Maribel, we've got a first on the Audaciousness Podcast this time, haven't we? Two guests. We've interviewed two guests. So yes. Tell us a little bit, how did that come about and who are we going to hear from today?
We're going to listen to a conversation, an extremely interesting conversation we had with Alistair and Peter. And the way we found out about them, this was one of the recommendations. Alistair was recommended that we interview him by one of our guests from last year, Mark Matamisa, who is from Zimbabwe, just as Alistair. And when I was talking to Alistair and finding out what he does, then he was the one who suggested, hey, but why don't we invite my business partner from the consultancy that I run so that we can listen to his opinion? And that's how we ended up having also a conversation with Peter from South Africa. They're both based in South Africa. And it was delightful, don't you think, Ellen?
It was, yes. So we listen to the interview with Alistair and Peter now, and then we'll come back in half an hour to talk about what we learned. Here's Alistair and Peter. We hope you enjoy the interview.
Thank you very much to be joining us today. Today is the first time I want to introduce Alistair and Peter, who are joining us today. It's the first time that we have two guests on our podcast. And it was at the beginning when Alistair suggested, hey, but let's include Peter, or let's invite Peter to our call. I got a little nervous. It's like, oh my goodness, we've never done this. Helen, what do you think? Should we do this? And Helen, yes, let's go for it. So welcome both of you, Alistair and Peter, to our podcast Audaciousness. I would like to start with my first question that we usually ask to all our guests. What is it that you do? And what audacious things have you done?
Alistair, can you go?
Yeah, I'll go first. Yeah, hi, Maribel, Helen, and Peter. Thanks for having us over on your show for today. To answer your question, so my name is Alistair Maigurira. I am based in Cape Town, and I run a diversity and inclusion consultancy called SALTR. It's an acronym for South Africa, Let's Talk About Race. And how this journey started was I moved to South Africa 17 years ago. I was born and raised in a neighboring country called Zimbabwe, which is next to South Africa. So the racial dynamics there are totally different to what I was experiencing and noticing in South Africa. So I always wondered why people don't really connect across racial lines. So about 4 years ago, I was quite nervous. I think that's where the audacity started, when I said to myself, let me start a YouTube channel on talking about race. So it was different topics where race impacts pretty much all walks of life, like in sport, in schools, in business. So the idea was to always have like a panel from different races to discuss something happening, say in sport or in schools. Or I now remember there was an episode we were planning to do on white parents who adopt black kids. You know, apparently it's a whole community and they have their own challenges. So what I'd realized was we come into this race conversation from different perspectives and different lenses in life that we view this conversation from. So I wanted to include everybody. So the show never really took off because I couldn't get funding from corporates, because I wanted the show to really have impact. So I only shot one episode, which I never published. If somebody wants to watch it, then they can contact me. Where I just interviewed different people to just share their story and how they want to talk about race. So that was the birth of Salter. And then in the wake of George Floyd's unfortunate murder, the whole world had this whole awakening around issues around diversity and inclusion and race. So I pivoted all that knowledge and content and networks I had from preparing for the talk show to set up a diversity and inclusion consultancy. So what we do is we get into businesses and we support leaders to have an inclusive workforce. That is the goal of the work that we do, because people spend most of their time at work. So I think that's where most of the work needs to be done. So along the journey, I met Peter and he's aligned to the same vision. We don't always agree on everything, which is a good thing. That means we have a cognitively diverse team, and then we challenge each other, and that's how we can move forward. So that's my introduction from my side.
Beautiful. Thank you, Alistair. Well, over to you, Peter.
Okay, my journey, and I think it's always been my most exciting journey, has been into the area of what was then called, in the sort of 90s, it was called diversity management. I was initially as a social worker doing social work and addiction work, and then I moved into industry and did management training and development, and then eventually with the preparation for our new South Africa and the release of Mandela in the 90s, I got involved in diversity management, or managing diversity. And that took me unexpectedly very deep into the whole issue of culture change in South Africa, preparing South African business for the changes that were coming about, like affirmative action, and confronting some of our past in South Africa. And if you know anything about South Africa, one of our initial big strategies to move the country forward was called a reconciliation process. And it was spearheaded by a number of people. But what we did then in the workplace, eventually, after I left Old Mutual, I was working in a financial and insurance environment for 7 years. At the end of that is when I got involved in a diversity area, and then moved into doing culture surveys in the workplace across the whole of the organization, working with developmental teams, task teams, top management teams to initiate change in the organization. And the changes were critical because of the barriers between the different cultures, specifically Black and colored, or people of color in the South African context, were left out of everything. They were left out of industry. They were left out of jobs. Jobs were blocked for them. And we didn't know each other. So we had to go through what we eventually used was a storytelling process and many other processes to change the landscape in South Africa. I think that's all I want to say for now. I think there's so much I can talk about, but it's been a really exciting process, which I was involved in for a period of about 10 years of my life. And then I've moved into other things I'm doing as a main business area, some other things on the technology and also people side, coaching, et cetera, et cetera. But the work that I've did for me was the most exciting. And that was, as I say, from the 70s, from the 90s to the end of the of 1990.
Thank you so much for those introductions. there are lots of things that I would love to ask, but I need to start just with one. So I'm just going to choose the first one that comes to mind. And that question is, race, what is that? And how do we talk about it? How can we have a conversation about race that is inclusive and respectful?
I think the first thing around race conversations is creating psychological safety on both sides, or should I say on all sides, right? So one of the biggest hindrances from having the conversation is that people are just too scared to have it. You know, you could easily get canceled. And also, and we'll maybe talk about this later, the trauma impact of race. And that also makes people not want to get themselves involved in the race conversation. So I would say the best, which is our approach at Salta, is to use a coaching approach to having a conversation around race. Because everyone, every single human on earth has had a different experience around matters around race. So that's why storytelling and coaching is critical in this line of work, because if you have a cookie cutter approach, then people will not be able to connect with you and each other in having this kind of conversation.
And what about the concept of race? What is that? Is race just the color of your skin? Is it connected to some cultural identity? How do we define race? Just to like have a starting point that we all have a common understanding of, or I understand your definition of race.
Well, can I respond to that quickly? And I probably think that Alistair and I will disagree on this. Quite possible.
Excellent.
We've actually never sat down and defined this, which is interesting. Maybe it's the nature of it. It's actually undefinable. And I'll tell you why. In the South African environment, we have 11 different language groups. The majority of them, except for two, or let's call them, they're national languages, accepted as our national languages. Two of them is English and Afrikaans, which one you know, and the other one is sort of a Dutch derivative of a language. But the other nine are all African languages. African black languages. So the history of South Africa has been very, very polarized, as you know, along race and color lines, mainly color. When people talk about race, very often in the South African context, you're talking about black, white, and colored, those three kind of groupings. But for me, race goes far beyond that. You know, if we think of countries where there's been ethnic cleansing, the Hutus and the Tutsis, are they different races or not? They have different languages. They saw themselves as different, you know, races. That's why they had the wars that they had. I think there's many cultural elements that define race, not only color. I think there's many, many other aspects that define and set them apart. I think if I think of the Jewish people, I think of them as a very unique breed of people. I mean, they'll never accept that they're part of the normal run of the mill of human beings. They will see themselves as a separate race with their own language, with their own culture, with their own. I'm trying to think of the word now, their own rituals. And so for me, it's probably, if I had to put it together, it's color, it's culture, it's language, it's where people stay on the planet, it's also how they people define themselves. You know, that so that's my take on that tricky question.
Mm. What do you think, Alistair? What is race for you?
Yeah, so for me, race is simply one's lived experience, right? So I think it is very critical to understand what we're trying to solve for, right? So what normally happens is we look at skin color or even gender and try to solve for that. And then it leads us nowhere. What we need to solve for is the human connection, right? And human connection, inclusion, is through understanding each other's lived experiences. So like what I said earlier, it's like, even if you grow up in the same house, or even if you're twins, your inclusion journey in the world is totally different, because every human is unique. That's the first thing. And the other thing is, within that lived experience, there is the impact of trauma, right? And how that now becomes an issue in your life depends on whether it's big trauma or small trauma. So that's what race is to me in a nutshell. It's about your lived experience. So the whole idea is to see the world through somebody else's lens. And that way we can create that connection.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that. I like that definition of lived experience, because, well, this topic is for me, well, it touches me, because if I think of myself and of my identity, people would describe me as, I'm from mixed race. I'm from the Caribbean. I'm not white. I'm not black. I'm kind of like a little bit of everything. I get light in the winter and then very dark in the summer. So is it the color of my skin? Is it the first language that I speak? When I meet here other African women and hear what they say, I don't connect with that, so because that's not my experience, because I'm not African. So is it more like, yes, that's why this living experience.
So how do you identify as, if I was to ask you that question? Do you identify as Latina? Do you not?
Black? I'm Maribel.
I was going to say the same thing. Is that a valid question to identify as something? I am a human spirit.
Could it be that using the word race is blocking our ability to talk about the topic? If we're thinking in these terms of I'm from this race or whatever, that we're trying, because automatically I feel like we're trying to compare. So what am I? What is my identity? Do I identify with any one of these labels? And who are you? Like I said, I'm comparing myself to other people who come from different experiences. And I think, well, no, that's not me. I don't feel like that. Or I don't speak French or English. That's not my first language. Should we leave that word, the word race, outside of the conversation and then just focus in inclusive communities? Would that be better?
So going back to the issue of lived experiences, right? People are on different levels of development, or should I say awareness, right? So we need to be cognizant of, you know, the level of development of maybe say language around these issues that people are at. So there are certain people who understand it from a race perspective, as in the word, you know, and some people understand it from the term inclusion. And like Helen, from what I'm getting, she's more on the spiritual side of things, right? So the idea is to meet Helen where she's at, to understand her view on race from a spiritual level, for example, you know. So I think it, and now you see there's so many acronyms around this industry. There's diversity and inclusion, diversity, equity and inclusion, diversity, equity, inclusion and belonging. And now there is access as well. So I think that sort of distracts us from the main issue of human connection, right? So I think going back again to that lived experience, and it comes through conversation to understand where another person's coming from, that is very critical. So I think using the word race, I guess, is sort of to bring attention to the topic, because it's just a social construct, right? like most things. But how we do the race work is where the difference comes in. You know, some people will do, for example, something I don't totally support. It's got a place in this whole industry, but I haven't really seen it being effective. Unconscious bias training, you know. I mean, Maribel, you also went through training at the Neuro Leadership Institute for Coaching, and they've identified at least just under 200 biases. Mm-hmm. So how can you get rid of 200 biases in a 3-day workshop, for example? You know, so you kind of have to come up with innovative ways for people to have that psychological safety to have a constructive conversation moving forward.
I'd like to ask a question about the challenges that you faced in doing what you're doing. Peter, you specifically mentioned that in the 90s, you know, you were in doing diversity management and in this reconciliation process. And obviously South Africa has had its own particular history and particular challenges and problems. And we just had the discussion about race, even identifying what race is and all of the myriad different ways that people can view race. Alistair, you mentioned at the beginning of the conversation about the YouTube channel, that you needed funding for that and that wasn't available. So you've mentioned some challenges already. I'm just wondering what other challenges you've faced, particularly in your situation, to get out there and do the audacious work that you're doing?
Well, if I can answer initially just the past obstacles, and then some of them are still very relevant today. The past obstacles was obviously the actual distance between people, where they stayed. For example, on the mines, I did work on 4 different mines, very, very big mines. And there was pressure from the external overseas community that actually had all their shares in these mines to change. They didn't want to change. Essentially, all management didn't want to be changed because they were run by white aristocrats. But there was pressure from the outside. And one of the realities of the design of the mines was the compounds, they were called compounds, and that's housing blocks of houses that were there for only the black people. And many of them actually came from, you know, the northern areas of South Africa, outside of South Africa, and from Swaziland, which is inside South Africa, included inside South Africa. And so these had to be dismantled, or they had to be re-looked at, because they created barriers, actually physical barriers. And in our society as well, there still are these physical barriers, the physical barriers of how we live. So if you look at sort of a concentric circle, 3 circles, the inner circle would be the white people staying closest to the metropolitan, closest to the actual city or the CBD areas. Then the next ring outside of that would be the colored communities. And the outside of that would be the black communities. And they were strategically designed like that. And to dismantle that, and to do actual, not just social reengineering, which we need to be doing, and we are doing, through black economic empowerment, affirmative action, and this diversity inclusion work. That's what we have to do. We have to change the nature and the fabric of our society. So getting people to talk across those boundaries and borders and meet each other. For example, who goes to the, you know, movies and films in town, and who's got the money to travel from the extremities of our cities to the inside? It's the people that have got the money. So even if they are affluent black people, they're going to have the money to come and to move wherever they want to. But people who don't have the money, they're not going to even go up Table Mountain where we stay, this most beautiful city, because the cost of going up the mountain, if you had to go by the cable car, is extremely expensive. So then the disproportionate incomes, I mean, that is a big barrier to us changing our society. It was a big problem then, and it still is a big problem now. How do people meet? They meet over coffee and a meal and all that kind of thing. But what if you don't have the money to go to your local restaurant or a restaurant in town, you know, or go to theater or all of these kind of places, culture theaters? So those are some of the really big stumbling blocks. In the workplace, I think something that Alistair and I are still finding and hearing about and we're confronting is the fact that people, that management and businesses, they are still switched off. They feel it's business as usual. In South Africa, we haven't had the George Floyd situation yet. We've had that in the past, which is what precipitated a lot of our change in South Africa. But at the moment, in a sense, there aren't the hot spots, the places of heat that bring about or will and can bring about change. People would say to you, yes, we've got black economic empowerment policies and plans, and we got a bit of this, and we got a bit of that, we got a bit of that. But in actual fact, there's a sense of, but we're okay. You know, we're actually okay. And this is a problem for me, from my point of view.
So do you think there has to be some kind of major event like the, you know, like there was in South Africa in the 90s that you were talking about, or the example of George Floyd that you gave, for something to happen? Because you're saying, you know, it's kind of, it's okay, it's moving on, but there's not the impetus to do something about it. So are you saying that something bad is going to have to happen before it gets better?
I think I'd like to hear Alistair's idea on this, but my experience, because I've specialized in the sort of pathological world of addiction work with alcoholism and drug addiction, etc., what I've realized very clearly is that people really only change when there is a significant crisis. So, yes, I believe we should have, or we should have crisis to facilitate it, a change. Or as change agents, we need to facilitate a crisis. We need to bring about crisis, which can be through facts, information, conscientizing people. What we did in the 90s was to use industrial theater. And the industrial theater was provocative as well as evocative. And I believe if we can do things in our society again, which bring forward the realities, we can do the work that we must do. On the other hand, there are hotspots, and it spikes every now and again. We hear about this in a school or in a business, but I think it just gets stifled. People don't want to confront. They don't want to confront the race issue. They don't want to confront the language issue. They don't want to confront the diversity issues such as gender, etc., etc. So that's just my take on it. Alistair, I don't know what do you feel about this?
Well, look, I would say it's all on us, the change agents. I would like to consider myself a D&I evangelist at this point. And you're asking about challenges. Look, depending on where you do your research, the D&I industry, you know, I read somewhere it's a $300 billion industry. So it can be lucrative, right? But we need to be aware of the kind of interventions that are in place to deal with these issues. So a lot of money is spent, and coaches, consultants get wealthy, and there is no true transformation, you know? So that's a challenge I've faced in seeing that, because it's very lucrative, it could be beneficial for people to have the problem in place for the continuation of the problem, you know, because then, you know, there'll still be business. One of my favorite TED Talks by this lady called Fadzi Wande, and she says, our job as D&I strategists is to work ourselves out of jobs, right? That is the goal. So if we continue doing this work, it means we're not doing it right. So what should we do? So another challenge that I faced is lack of collaboration in the industry. You reach out to people and emails get ignored. And these are some of the people that I really look up to, you know, as gurus in the D&I space. That's the one thing. Another thing that I've faced as a challenge is, I guess this is now a deep issue of different perspectives where I was misunderstood a lot in the beginning, because I came from a corporate background in finance, had to upskill as a coach. And because I had, you know, new ideas I wanted to inject into the industry. So I faced a lot of friction in the beginning. But one thing I realized in that process is that people are at different levels of understanding what's really going on, you know? So most of my work, particularly one-on-one work, is focusing on trauma. You know, there's a huge impact of racial trauma that people of color have experienced, not just in South Africa, across the globe, in America, in Brazil, right? So when people are dysregulated and they are going through trauma or have been triggered, it is very difficult for you to have any form of rational intervention without handling that trauma aspect, you know? So that whole concept of trauma, I feel it's misunderstood and it's gaining traction. You know, you've got your Gabor Mate's and Thomas Hubel's that are sort of evangelizing the whole trauma thing. But I think where I am right now in South Africa, there's a lot that we need to do to conscientize leaders that there's a history of trauma, and the way trauma works is it comes up again, right? So people talk about microaggressions. That is, you know, I guess a trauma incident that needs to be managed well.
If you ask any psychotherapist, they would say, if you do not heal the trauma first, you won't be able to change your behavior in a positive way to deal with challenges in a healthy way, because you have this trauma. Now, you both have been talking about changes that need to be done. And I'm wondering, do these people from different, as Peter was mentioning, that there are these three circles in South Africa, do they really want to connect to each other? In order to make this change to happen, don't we need to heal the trauma first? And how do you heal that collective trauma?
The first point should be creating awareness. So they say you need to name it to tame it. We need to know what you're dealing with. And going back to one of your first questions, like, what is race, right? So if we look at things from a race perspective, I don't think we'll get anywhere. But if we look at race from a trauma-informed perspective, then we can find the right solutions. We can design the right solutions moving forward. So I'll give you an example about the COVID pandemic, right? When it started, the information was we need to get ventilators and this pandemic will end. That was some news that was in mainstream news, right? So all the efforts were focused on finding ventilators so that the hospitals have enough ventilators, right? But people were still dying on those ventilators until more information came along and the first responders and the doctors were able to now find out what the real issue was with this pandemic. And I think the same applies to the issues around race and racial trauma. It's first to have that awareness that there is a racial trauma issue. And then from there, we come up with solutions that can solve the problem. And the thing about trauma is it's personal, right? Everybody has a different experience. Although it's collective, everyone has a different experience. So hence why coaching, therapy, counseling, which is more on a one-on-one level, helps each individual to process that unprocessed hurt, you know, and then from there, they can be more present in the society.
Thank you for that explanation. Would you like to add anything on healing trauma, Peter?
I want to sort of keep something very complex a little bit more practical. Based on the experience that I had in those 10 years, you know, if I was a psychologist, maybe I would have handled things very differently. I'm not a psychologist, I'm a social worker. Well, I was a social worker back then, and I was a consultant, a facilitator consultant. And my job, I suppose, and the model we were using was actually working with groups of 30 to 40 people at a time. And that's after we did a culture survey, after we did a whole process of discussion with the management team and got them to buy in the process. We used industrial theater. We sensitized what Alistair was talking about. We sensitized the environment. People were then freed up to talk about the issues of race, of difference, of culture, etc. And we walked into very difficult situations. Our main organization that we walked into had a lot of tension with the trade unions or labor unions. So there was a lot of polarization, not only along race, but it was along race because the labor unions were also divided along the racial lines. So our big groups came after a process of auditing, feedback to all the staff, negotiation with the unions, negotiations with management, getting them together around the boardroom, and then eventually diving deep into the workshops. And it was only a two-day workshop for all staff, but everybody went through those two-day workshops in big groups. And my belief is that through the storytelling process, which was the main process we were using and the main skill that we were facilitating, people started to connect with each other. They started to listen to each other's stories. And I believe they started de-traumatizing. And I've got a lot of events to tell you about that. I've got a lot of examples. Now, the thing was that it wasn't just a quick in and quick out. This was an eight to 10 month process, because we left behind a task force that was orientated to take the results from the culture audits and to implement them in the workplace, where there were communication problems, where there were race issues, where there was issues of disparity of salaries, where there were, people were perceived and discrimination, where there was real discrimination. They were meant to take those issues and deal with them in the workplace. And we were brought in when and as we needed. And we did then, after about an six to eight month process or a year process, we would do a further and updated audit. But in the meantime, we left behind the task force and we upskilled, we trained up facilitators to run those workshops and run any other workshops that were needed. But again, we had a recipe. And I think if we had done more intensive trauma debriefing work, things could have gone a lot deeper. I do think that we needed to do more. If I look back, we needed to do more of the one-on-one work or one-on small group work, because there were people that were obviously that were maybe stuck in their traumatic experiences, and they were traumatized. We had created it by the time we got to our workshops. We call them diversity workshops, the two-day workshop. We'd already created enough impetus and momentum for people to actually start sharing and opening their story. I think in opening their wounds, you know, and starting to deep traumatize.
I like the fact that you're talking about storytelling, Peter, and Alistair, you talked about it before. I think storytelling is a very powerful tool, isn't it?
It is.
I just want to go back to one thing in terms of Alistair. I think you mentioned before about, is this your ultimate aim, that your services will no longer be required because the world will be de-traumatized and healed? What is your ultimate aim in terms, you know, what is your visit, your longer term vision in terms of this?
Yeah, so I actually took 2 months off work unpaid, working on vision, mission, values, and all of that. And the vision is to create an inclusive world. So, and look, I've been guilty of coming into, you know, spaces, even the race conversation with my own worldview, right? I have a default of coming into the conversation from a head space, right? But through coaching and training, I can now get into these conversations from an emotional place, from a heart place. So now if you want to connect with someone, you have to connect with them where they're at, from a heart perspective or a head perspective. And I recently was talking to somebody I used to work with in the finance space. And I said, oh, I now run a diversity and inclusion consultancy. And then he said, oh, that's very important because these millennials don't like to work, right? So guy's in his 60s and he's got issues with younger generations, right? And at that point, I was like, whoa, I've never looked at inclusion from a generational or other age perspective. So what I mainly do is actually create coaching products that address a particular D&I need. So I'm currently designing a D&I product that looks at D&I from a generational perspective, right? Whether you're Gen Z, you're a millennial, etc. So like I said in the beginning, it's about creating connection. So if you focus on the race thing or the age thing, right? Or the gender thing, we're going to miss the mark. Right? It's about creating connection. And if the entry point is using the word race or using the word generations or using the word gender, that will be the entry point. But the end goal is to create connection, whether it's across races or across generations. And then that way we have an inclusive world. I mean, right now we in what, April 2022, and there's this Russia-Ukraine crisis, right? There are arguments on both sides of the fence. And those arguments will not take us anywhere. The whole idea is to now say, okay, how do we create connection? That should be the end goal. And not to say, this is the right country or the right political party, because that creates polarization, right? Because facts won't get us anywhere. It's always moving to a place of creating connection. And that's how we're going to create an inclusive world for future generations. And then we won't have any jobs by then as D&I consultants.
It's a beautiful response. Peter, do you want to add anything to that?
Well, very simply, just knowing human nature and human nurture and human choice and human DNA, I think we'll always have work. We'll always have work. It's like saying, you know, all the psychologists, none of them have run out of work. None of the social workers have run out of work. In actual fact, the world has become more complex. You know, there's more of an understanding over there's Generation X, there's Generation Y, and maybe there's Generation Z coming on. You know, what a Generation Zero. But it seems as if we still have so many of the old problems that we had, probably right in the beginning of our races, you know, because of the human factor. So that's my feeling about it.
Just to add on to what Peter just said about the human condition. One of the things that helped me to really understand what's going on in the race space is the whole us versus them concept. It's always going to be there because we're naturally biased towards our own kind. So that will never go away from a neuroscience perspective, from a spiritual perspective. But if we can have the systems in place for us to manage that, there'll be less work for us, for the industry to have, right? It'll be a once-off thing maybe here and there. But I think it's critical for us to do the work now, laying down the foundations for the next generation to inherit, and not to inherit a crisis, but rather to inherit something they can build on so that 2-3 generations from now, we can have an inclusive world. So it'd be more about maintenance work, I guess, and not starting from scratch. That's the vision, you know, I have for my line of work and the industry.
Perfect.
So the last question that all our guests get to answer, is connected with the name of our podcast, which is Audaciousness. The audacious part relates to having the audacity to come up with such a goal in the first place. And the word ness is used to describe a spit of land that juts out into the sea. So in other words, kind of like the solid grounding, and you are surrounded by this constant change, by those waves, tumultuous motion of water. So for us, audaciousness means having a solid grounding on which to practice your audacity. While you are pursuing your goal, your very audacious goal, where do you get the solid grounding to continue while everything else is in motion? How do you stay grounded in your vision despite what life throws at you?
So, like I said in the beginning, I looked at race in the beginning from a head space, a rational space, right? And I remember telling my friend about wanting to start the YouTube channel and all of that. And he said to me, you need to pray about this. You're going to need covering. And I thought he was crazy. And the more I moved into the D&I space, right, I know there's a spiritual element to it. And particularly if you look at it from through a trauma lens and you one-on-one in it with a client, and you just like maybe all the books you've read, all the seminars, courses you've attended, there is nothing in those books to kind of help that person at that particular point. And I think and I feel that my Christian beliefs support me in this journey. It's not always easy, but I feel it's a calling for me to be in this line of work. I mean, I could share a lot of stories about what's happened from just leaving the finance world to get into, you know, the human side of things, right? I don't think I'd have done it without a higher power, just reaching out to a higher power and having hope through that higher power as a Christian, just knowing that Jesus is there to support me in my line of work, you know, regardless of the race or religion or gender of the other person that I'm working with. It's just that is very, very critical, because some of the things that happen in this space, I cannot explain, and no book or course I've attended can explain, you know, the transformation that I've witnessed.
Okay. It's actually very simple, and it's in line with the spiritual side. It's my faith. I think my faith has been the strongest driving force in my life, and certainly in the work that I do, in all the work I do. And I do that with gratitude and a deep sense of awe that I can do the work I'm doing, because I do a lot of work. I do other things as well that aren't people orientated. They are, you know, do web design, and I do, you know, graphic design, all those kind of things. But even those I do with a passion for the people that I'm working with, and the gratitude, you know, for that, and the coaching work. So I'm just aware of the difficulties that people are facing, that our society is facing. That's why I took on the work of being a social activist many years ago. But I've been able to do it. I believe the strength has come from my spiritual roots and also my spiritual practices.
Thank you for sharing that.
Perfect. Thank you.
Well, thank you very much for this fantastic conversation, Alistair and Peter. It was such a pleasure to hear your views and to learn about race, lived experience, and conversations that connect people. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Alistair and Peter. Maribel, interviewing two guests worked then, didn't it?
Yes, indeed.
And, yeah, unfortunately, we lost Peter at the end of the call, which is why we don't hear him sign off. But we did manage to get a very interesting conversation out of that. And I want to commend you first, Maribel, on pushing for the definition of race. You really pushed on that question. Yes. What is it? What is it? So my first question to you is, was your question answered satisfactorily in the interview? And what other thoughts have you had on this topic since we had this conversation with Peter and Alistair a couple of weeks ago?
I think, yes, that it was answered satisfactorily to the extent that in our conversation, we, let's say, agreed on the definition. And that's what I like the most, that race is an experience. And it's more than just the color of the skin of a person. It's their own experiences, is their country's history, is the culture connected to that, their own personality, their own experiences in their family. So it's such a complex thing that I liked the, or I was satisfied with the definition that it's a personal and individual experience. To be honest, I have always identified myself as Latina. But when Alistair asked me that question, I thought, nah, I don't want that label. Because why? Because I have the feeling that I have become more than that. Because I've been living 20 years in Germany and you have no idea how strict I am making appointments now. I just experienced that in the last few days. 20 years ago, someone would tell me, yeah, let's meet at 3:30. I would be totally relaxed. And now I'm not anymore, because the experience of living in Germany, where punctuality is important and time is seen linear, I had to adapt to that, and that has become part of me, which is okay. So I'm not Latina anymore, and that's why I said, well, I'm just Maribel, and that is what I have experienced. I wonder, how do you feel about race, Helen? Do you identify as something, or have you, maybe you did before, and now this has changed for you, that I forgot what were your words exactly when Alistair asked me that question. It's just, do you remember what you said?
I do. My response was, is that even a valid question to ask about what you identify as? Because I am a human spirit.
Yeah,
that's the first thing that came out of my mouth. And I think, yes, possibly previously I did identify, because, you know, society puts us into boxes, and we've had this conversation with other people before that that these labels, you know, the label that you were given that you don't identify with, that wasn't a label that you gave yourself anyway. It was a label given to you by society because of the place that you were born and the language that you speak, and to an extent the color of your skin and your parentage and so on. And so these are just labels that we're given anyway. And so I guess, you know, like anybody else entering society, I kind of accepted, yes, these are the labels. You know, I'm white, I'm British, I'm, you know, whatever, all of these labels that people give me. And so it's only really been lately, as I've been accelerating myself on my spiritual journey, that I've realized how utterly bizarre it is to live our lives according to these labels which other people give you. And so I've just started letting all of those labels fall by the way and just say, you know, we are all unique. Alistair said this before, every human is unique. So if we were all to label ourselves, we would have almost 8 billion labels. And I think Claire even mentioned this, and Claire Tonner in the podcast, the episodes that we were talking to her about, because, you know, we're part of the collective. There are more that binds us, you know, there are more things that connect us than actually divide us. And yet we tend to focus on all the things that separate us, don't we, by labeling things. And I just think that quite frankly, is wrong. I don't see the use of it. And I think that that is one of the reasons why we have so many conflicts and wars and disagreements and so on. Yeah, I just don't see why we should be living in societies like this.
Indeed. I mean, what benefit does it bring? It's just creating division and looking for differences, when actually, just as being part of the race of human beings, then that's just it. Because actually, if we really even, I think this was in Harari's book, that actually, if we go and analyze it from the biological point of view, there we are just one race.
The human race, exactly. The
Homo sapiens is just one race, as opposed to, like, for example, dogs. You know, that they are called canis something, canis whatever. And we are all Homo sapiens. That's it. That's the race.
Yeah. And I thought it was, again, you asked a very good question about, is talking about race actually blocking us from getting on with our lives, you know, without even considering race? But I thought Alistair did give a very good reply about that, you know, just getting the word out there kind of identifies that there is a problem with it, you know, and that it is, he rightly said, race is a human construct, you know, because my philosophy now is, if it doesn't exist in nature, then it doesn't exist.
Okay.
And so you've got, there's so many constructs that we've created as human beings, which are just stories, you know, they're fictions. The whole concept, construct of how we organize ourselves in societies, you know, with governments and with leaders, and, you know, the money that we use, you know, that doesn't have a value. It's just we think it has a value, we attach a value to it, but it doesn't really have a value, because we, you know, we convince ourselves that it is worth something. And so if it's a human construct, you know, animals don't organize themselves into these societies like that, with governments and with money and with laws and all of this, then you have to be aware, I think, that this is just a human caused thing, or a human created thing. And then what we tend to do is add the suffix ism to this construct that we've made, and then say, and that means it's a problem, you know. So you've got like racism, ageism, sexism. Is basically saying, we've created these divides, and now we're saying that there's a problem with it that has to be solved. And like Alistair said, there are a lot of vested interests in it that people are quite happy continuing believing that there's a problem.
Well, it's a million-dollar business, this DEI trainings. And what I think 10 years ago, it was the mindfulness, what was the new thing. So yeah, definitely.
But bringing it back to the, you know, being audacious, how do we be audacious with the, you know, the issue of racism or race being out there? And so what I was thinking about that was, you know, we are all unique, we are all individual human beings. Every man and woman is unique. We are connected to each other. We are all worthy. We are worthy of a seat at the table. You know, we are worthy of doing what it is, achieving our full potential, regardless of what our background is and what labels other people give us. So I think possibly, you know, this is what I want to say in terms of how this affects our audaciousness, is basically don't let people label you and say you are not worthy of a seat at the table because of your skin color, your first language, the place where you grew up, you know, other backgrounds. That's what probably I would say on that point.
Yes, definitely. Indeed, I completely agree with you on that. The thing is, though, I would say, or I dare say, that at least for example, you and I, we have consciously developed our understanding of this, of who we are, and actively seeking to understand more and to uncover all those layers that we learned, that we kind of like automatically learned from our parents. And this is the legacy that goes from one generation to the next. But then there's a lot of people who are not aware of this, who, like Mike said, just don't question anything. This is how you do it. And that story of the monkeys, that's like, remember, like,
that was in the last episode. Yeah.
Yes, in the last episode, monkeys, a group of monkeys learned that they can't, I think, jump on the wall. And without knowing, then everybody just follows, because that's what you learn from one generation to the next. And then you don't question it. And in order to help the young adults or help next generations to uncover all those, to take off all those layers of things that they have learned, we do need to have the conversation, and we do need to raise the topic. Because yes, we say, you and I both say, yes, there's more that unites people or similarities and separates that, but we're talking from a theoretical point of view. Yes, mm-hmm. we both agree on that, but the reality is a different one. Life is not like that.
I agree. And I think this probably brings me on to the last point that I want to mention. I thought Alistair made a very good point about the impact of trauma. You know, whether it's big trauma or small trauma, we probably all experience some kind of trauma, you know, on an individual level, and it affects us all sure. very much. Mm-hmm. But also humanity is going through a huge collective trauma at the moment. You know, if people are experiencing trauma, and then they grow up and have children of their own, and they haven't sorted out their own trauma, then they carry on that trauma, yeah. you know, pass on that trauma to their children. And so the cycle continues. And it yeah. seems to me anyway, that we've reached a point in humanity where everybody seems to be traumatized in some way. And that's why the world is as it is. You know, we need to heal. Each of us needs to heal on an individual basis in order for us to heal on a collective basis, and then to live more harmoniously with our planet and with each other.
Yeah, definitely. The only way of stopping this cycle is that at some point, one generation realizes the trauma that they have, heals it, stops the legacy, and the children of these people will not have that trauma, because they will be educated in a different way without all these little boxes and all these things that you need to do this, and that's how you need to live, and this is what a good human being is.
Mm. Which is what Alistair was indicating. He mentioned that towards the end of the interview, that's what they were hoping for, you know, to achieve. And Peter also talked about, and I asked Peter the question, does there have to be a crisis for this to happen? You know, so do mm-hmm. we have to instigate a crisis? Or isn't the world in crisis enough already that we should be doing this? You know, how much more dire does the situation have to be until we stop this vicious cycle of traumatized humanity?
I think it doesn't hurt bad enough so that people change their behavior. It's just, yeah, that's just my very own personal opinion. I admire very much what they are both are doing. And one thing that I definitely see the point that Alistair made, we can agree that race doesn't exist, not really, that it's a social construct, but definitely for the work that they're doing, it's a good way of starting the conversation, because somehow you need to start the conversation. And everyone, at least adults, will have some kind of experience or will have some kind of connection to the concept of race, even if it's just made up. Mm. But that's a good start to the conversation, and to be curious and just find out who this other person is and what their experiences are.
That's what's going to save us all, I think.
Agreed, Helen. Thanks very much for listening to this episode of our podcast, Audaciousness. We hope you enjoyed it as much as we did. A huge thanks to Alistair and Peter for taking the time to share their goal and journey with us. We are very much indebted in you, and we hope that it was an inspiring conversation to help you think from a different perspective in terms of race and inclusion.
Indeed. If you enjoyed this episode, please give it a like. And if you think someone else would benefit from listening to this conversation, please pass it on to them and share it with your friends and your family and your colleagues. And if you know of any other audacious people, including yourself, please get in touch, as we'd love to hear from you.
We'll be back in 2 weeks with another audacious guest and another audacious episode. See you soon. Bye.
Bye.